night, everyone. You're listening to The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
This is the Monday edition, affectionately also known as Rethink the Week. All right, so let me just start by telling you, we're now in the remote location, so everything is different. What does that mean? That means we tape Monday show at 4 o'clock on Sunday, and every show during the course of this week will be slightly delayed because of the inconvenience of COVID-19. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to get quality conversation, and you're not going to get breaking edge news. So that's the good part. But before we begin our show, and I introduce my guests, I want to remind everyone that we have begun every show for the last couple of weeks, if not months, with the words of Colonel Vindman from November of 2019, where he was testifying before Congress about his concerns during the impeachment hearing. And the most powerful lines that I keep thinking over and over again is where he sort of assures his father that it will be all right. We're going to play now the words of Colonel Vindman. You will hear these words, commit them to memory. In November of 2020, remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, let me introduce my guests. So it's our Rethink the Week. Our producer, Ken Barnes, is here. Thank you so much for joining us again, Ken. And thank you for doing this and pulling it together so we can sort of cut and paste and make it sound real quality by the time it gets up on Pacifica. It's a pleasure. We have, as always, Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He is on New Hampshire Public Radio for their version of The End of the Week. And he has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Dean.
Hi, Ernie. It's good to see you.
It's great. Dave Schultz, he's coming the farthest away. He's coming from Hamline University in Minnesota. He is both a professor of law as well as government or political science at Hamline. He also was on, ran the, I believe, Common Cause in Minnesota for how many years?
Oh, about a half a dozen years.
Wow. And my connection, although I don't remember you, I believe we were serving on in Common Cause at the same time. I was in the National Board of Common Cause for 6 years in the 90s. Yes. So how exciting. And not last in any way, shape, or form is Professor Stephen Pimpare. He is a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. He is a lecturer. He's a senior fellow. He is in the graduate school. His area of expertise is poverty and homelessness. Boy, we're going to need your level of expertise now. And I want to welcome Stephen Pimpare to the program.
Hi, Ernie.
As we tape the show, and again, I reminded everyone, we're taping it at 4 o'clock on the day before. The story that is breaking everyone as we come on the air is a story about a senator from Minnesota. So let me share this with you because in some ways it speaks to the challenge of COVID-19. It speaks to the challenge of government. It speaks to the people that have been rolling their eyes and blaming someone else and thinking that it's not as severe or as real. And in fact, it's made it very difficult for government to take any kind of real action. Here is the story. You'll hear more about it all night, I'm sure, on Sunday, but we're discussing this on Monday. Senator Rand Paul has tested positive for the coronavirus, his office announced on Twitter. Why it matters? He is the first U.S. senator to test positive. And according to his office, he is currently asymptomatic. Paul is a licensed physician and, quote unquote, a notorious deficit hawk, and was the only senator to vote against a bipartisan $8 billion bailout bill. He sought to introduce an amendment that would take the funding from the State Department and the rest of the U.S. agenda. Paul may be considered a high-risk patient for coronavirus because of his age and many other things. Rand Paul, I mean, you couldn't have made it up. It almost sounds like a piece from The Onion. You know, it's just remarkable. So I'm going to start with Dean. Dean, you're a presidential scholar. You're a civic scholar. This has been so interesting because it points out the weakness in every aspect of who we are as a nation and frankly, how we govern and how partisanship and a fact-free environment has made it so difficult for us to respond nimbly and quickly to what is happening with COVID-19. I guess I'm going to start with you. Other than rolling your eyes, what do you think about Rand Paul and that announcement that came out on Sunday?
Well, certainly, I'm not sure that it was a surprise. You know, we've seen a number of positive tests for people in and around the political universe in Washington, some high-dollar Republican donors, some congressional staffers, a couple of members of Congress have already quarantined. So I think there was a sense that at some point someone would contract it. I mean, obviously you wish him the best and you want him to succeed and be healthy. I mean, I'm exactly the same age. So I'm hoping he has a pretty easy go of it and maybe I'll feel a little bit better about this. But, you know, it speaks to the sort of the reality of the situation. It brings an immediacy to the policy deliberations. And, you know, there's been a lot of concern about the fragmented and conflicting response out of Washington. I'm going to be interested to see if this really changes anything or if he has an easy experience of it, if it is going to some way diminish it a little bit. I don't know exactly what's going to happen here, but it does add a new kind of human storyline to an already very political storyline.
Okay, so Stephen, I'm going to add a little more froth to this conversation. And how am I going to do that? I posted a comment from Mitt Romney, all right? It says, here's Mitt Romney telling reporters that a group of senators had lunch with Rand Paul on Friday, and he's now seeking advice as to whether he should self-quarantine. And when I posted it on Facebook, I put the following question at the top, Professor Pinder. When you are facing your maker, do you vote differently? And I hear what Dean is saying, that if he has an easy time, maybe it'll poo-poo it. I think a lot of the senators he met with are probably over the age of 60. Some of them may, in fact, be over the age of 70. Not all of them are in great health. And now they know that the person who sort of shook their hand or shared their lunch is the one that delivered it to him. And he's obviously been in somewhat denial and forcing the rest of us to sort of slow down the process of responding in an effective way.
Well, more beyond that, after he had tested positive and knew that he had tested positive, he then proceeded to go to the Senate, to go to the dining room, and to go to the Senate gym. So as we witness sort of the heap of misery that is coming barreling toward us, I will actually not mourn anything that Rand Paul suffers. And I'm not going to pretend that I wish him well, because I don't. And I think it is disingenuous given the harm that he has caused over the course of his career and the ways in which his ideology has caused harm.
Stephen, I don't consider my comments disingenuous at all. I'm sorry. I disagree with you. I'm just, you know, you don't want people to die unnecessarily. I don't think that's being, I'm not going to wish somebody else death.
There is only so much empathy and sympathy I can muster.
You can believe that.
Empathy and sympathy that I can muster, and I have none to spare for him. I think there's a larger,
Stephen.
Fair enough. No, I'm not.
Stephen, let me finish. You can believe whatever you want, but don't call me disingenuous.
I apologize. I did not mean to imply that. And I did not mean to imply that you should feel the way that I do.
Okay. But now I'm going to shift to my guy.
But let me just one quick thing, other Arnie's, because there's the larger sort of policy and political concern, is that after September 11th, there were a number of really sort of thoughtful continuity of government plans that people had put together, realizing, remember, right, that one of those planes was, we thought, either headed to the Capitol or the White House, could theoretically have taken out the entire Congress one fell swoop. There were all sorts of really smart plans putting together much more sophisticated continuity of government arrangements than we currently have. Those went nowhere. So we've got much larger concerns right now. If in fact the virus sweeps through Congress, what happens, right? How do we maintain a functioning legislative branch?
All right, Dave, this is almost like your cue. So you heard what Dean Spiliotta said, you heard what Steve said. So Dave Schultz, as I'm looking at this, it raises so many questions. It raises questions about how do we continue to govern if so many people are infected? How do we organize our votes when people are going to be told in Congress that they actually can't meet together? They're going to have to figure out an alternative way of meeting. How do we ensure what the term quorum means for the purposes of taking a vote? And is this also an opportunity? As I mentioned, Mitt Romney was concerned. He went to the gym. This is going to infect a lot of other people. And even though, as you heard from Dean Spiliotis, you know, Rand Paul may be a healthy guy and he may not find this debilitating, the other people that are infected may in fact be significantly debilitated. And it really shows people, I think, an interesting story. Even if you survive this, even if you're healthy, it's not about you. It's about who you touch. It's about who you infect. And now we begin to understand almost the real sense of community, that I may carry it to you and that was never my intent, but that means I need to behave differently.
Right. A couple of observations. One of them, I'm thinking of a great old Dire Straits song, which had a great line, which was what? Denial ain't just a river in Egypt. Despair ain't just an extra tire in a car. And the reason why I say that, over the weekend, there was a fascinating piece in the Washington Post all about COVID-19 deniers and sort of saying to the effect of, geez, I don't know anybody who's got COVID. I don't know anybody who's ill, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason why I mention this is that Rand Paul's infection, you know, with the virus, right, potentially is a transformative moment in America, but I don't think it's going to be. And the reason why I say potentially, it's when you start to get somebody who you know, or in this case, you know, for members of Congress, some very close, or somebody who's identified as a conservative, to say that, you know, this is the point where maybe now we realize that there's actually a connection, it's real and so forth, and something can happen. However, I'm going to be pessimistic, unfortunately, on this one and say that it's not going to change a lot of things necessarily. A, if Rand Paul recovers from it very quickly and doesn't show severe symptoms, I think his case study becomes an example for so many people to say much ado about nothing, and it feeds into the deniers. And if he does go into a worse direction in terms of what happens, I'm still not sure that this is enough to overcome the partisan divide. You know, as we speak at approximately 4 p.m. on Sunday, Congress, the Democrats and Republicans are just about deadlocked, about deadlocked over how to resolve the funding and the bailouts that are coming at this point. And so my point that I'm getting at here is that I hope you're right. I hope this becomes a basis for bonding, a basis for coming together. But I'm not sure that we're at a point yet in the United States that we can almost look back to the experiences of World War II as a way of moving forward in terms of bringing us together.
But Dave, don't you think that it can possibly be a group lesson for all Americans to see? Because whether Rand Paul gets better or not, there are probably a bunch of septuagenarian senators who are mighty damn worried now.
Oh, no.
I think that that's good for everybody, the American people, to get a sense of, look, you go out and do these selfish things where you could infect other people, and it hurts all of us. And
so
and
can I make it sick or not?
Yeah, let me just respond to that. I was going to say is that I would hope, and that's what I'm saying, I would hope that would be the rational and thinking person's response is to say that oftentimes we don't understand something until it touches us personally.
Of course.
That affects the senators. I'm playing a little bit of the devil's advocate in saying that at the end of the day, I don't know if this is enough to do that. I hope you're right. Ken, I hope you're absolutely right, but I don't know.
We can't play this out, but Dean, here's what I want to ask, is that I saw something at Slate.com, and the article at Slate.com in the money box was, do it all. They didn't want to, they're seeing the fighting between members of Congress, and they're not getting, there's the partisan divide. Do we give checks? How big a check? Do we go bail out government? Do we bail out Congress? Do we bail out, you know, states? Do we bail out corporations? And his suggestion was at this point is, what don't we do? and the idea of doing it all. And a lot of people see this as an opportunity to either fix the things that are so obvious have failed us. This is also an opportunity for the lobbyists to think, this is fabulous because I'm going to get exactly what I want because we're all so vulnerable and nobody will be paying attention to these enormous bills with these huge checks of trillions of dollars. Look what I can drive through with a Mack truck. And I am just trying to figure out how you respond nimbly and quickly as we move into this. And should we do it all? I mean, AOC had a really interesting point. Someone was saying that we should means test things, that only people who are poor or middle class or up to 200,000 should, you know, get a check. She said, give it to everybody. And then what she said, which I thought was brilliant, actually, because I said it on Friday on another show. But anyway, what she said was, we could always claw it back the next year if it turned out you got a check and didn't need it. So rather than spend the time trying to figure out what people's income is, send everyone, you know, especially those at the bottom and those struggling at the middle, what they need. And the other point I'm going to make, Dean, is that what my 2018 tax return looked like, what my 2019 when we filed last year, it ain't nothing like now. It ain't nothing like now. So while you're looking back at 75,000 last year or 150,000 last year, people could be wiped out this year. So it's better to err by sending everyone a check than trying to do something that seems reasonable when it's actually irrational.
Well, I think that's what we're going to see. I think we're going to see a kitchen sink approach. It sounds like what is taking shape is basically something for everyone. There'll be direct cash payments to citizens. There'll be some form of corporate bailout for various industries. And then there'll be some additional things in there to try to stabilize the markets and small business loans, et cetera. So I think they're erring in that direction at this point, something like $2 trillion, which is a remarkable price tag, given that if you remember back a few weeks ago when we started down this path, I think President Trump asked for $2.5 billion.
Exactly.
And Congress said, no, we're going to give you $7 or $8 billion. And now we're talking $2 trillion.
No,
so that's where we're headed, yeah.
It definitely is a come to Jesus moment. People, I think, didn't quite appreciate how horrific this was.
True.
But Stephen, let me ask you a question. And that is that I was listening to Andrew Cuomo, who is now actually the otherwise known as President Cuomo, because he's actually acting in a more presidential way. In some ways, he's being carried as a presidential. I mean, if you're looking for the truth, if you're looking for facts, if you're looking at how to organize a huge state the size of a country, if you're looking at where, you know, where the challenges are, you're not hearing it from the president, but you are hearing it from Andrew Cuomo. One of the things we're learning from Andrew Cuomo is that even as we're suddenly scrambling around the globe looking for the, what is it, N95 masks, or we're looking for, you know, gowns, or we're looking for whatever it is that they need, we now know that what used to be 80 cents is now $4. What used to be $18,000 is now $50,000. So I guess what I am just shocked about is that they didn't write a check on Friday already for every hospital and every medical facility in every single state so they could either buy it, or as Andrew Cuomo suggested, I don't want to have to compete with California and Minnesota and Mississippi since we all need the same equipment. What do we know? We should have an organized group buy. Therefore, we're not competing with each other. And the only place that can do an organized group buy is, frankly, the federal government. And yet Donald Trump says he's not in the business of shipping stuff.
And near as we can tell, midday Sunday, the bill that is being considered by the Senate does not contain any emergency funding for hospitals.
Oh,
this sort of whole exercise has made me sort of have very complicated thoughts about American style federalism, right? Because on the one hand, the demonstrated ineptitude at this moment of the federal government to step in the way in which one would like a federal government to step in is really revealing its failures. But is that a failure of the system itself, or is it a failure of the particular individual who at this moment is sitting atop it? And could you imagine a more centralized political system in which we didn't have the space for governors to step in and try to compensate for the failures in the executive branch? And I mean, I don't know that I've got a good answer to that. I think right now, given that there is probably no president in all of American history who is as ill-suited to the moment as Trump is for this one, maybe our only hope right now is for state governments to step in where the federal
government... I have a suggestion. Dave, tell me about this. So we know that there's a National Governors Association. I know because I wanted to be a governor. And I think it's Larry Hogan from Maryland is the head. He's actually a Republican, but a moderate Republican for sure. Dave, what if the governors got together and said, screw the government? We're going to buy as the NGA. You know, we'll figure it out. We'll put our money together. Let's operate as 50 states in almost an Articles of Confederacy. You know what I mean? Like operate this way so that we're not competing with each other and we're actually doing it. If the government won't step in, could the governors, the way we do in New England? So for example, in New England, David, we have something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. What happened was a number of states in New England got together to talk about kind of how we deal with the carbon issue. And we actually created our own little sort of envelope within the 50 states to do our own approach. We've seen that happen in the New England area, including New York, I believe, New Jersey. What if the states decided to do this, as right now the federal government is actually failing us because they're not acting in a rational way and in a nimble way? Dave?
Well, a couple of observations. Under, let's say, the theoretically best model of federalism, if it exists here, what would be happening at this point is that the federal government would be providing the overall, let's say, cash and the overall, let's say, sort of goals to help the states coordinate together. And that would be our ideal model. And the reason why I mention that is, as a couple things I want to say here, is that states left to their own probably don't have the resources to tackle this. And two, this is a classic sort of tragedy of the commons problem where one state can't solve it on its own. It's going to take, again, coordination across all states. But I want to come back to something you said before where you said, do it all. I think that is actually the actual wrong approach.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm saying that is that it's kind of like saying, let's take $2 trillion and throw money at a problem and solve it. That's how things don't get solved, how don't things get worked. And so if I were going to pick this apart, things that I would do, for example, I think Bernie Sanders is absolutely correct in the idea of saying that maybe what we ought to do is not a one-time cash of $1,000, whatever. It's probably, $2,000 per adult for the duration of this crisis. Two, I think Elizabeth Warren is correct where she came out over the weekend and said that we ought to attach stipulations to any types of bailouts.
No, exactly. No stock buybacks, please.
And three, what I worry about with just sort of throwing $2 trillion at it is that a lot of that money is going to get wasted. It's going to go into lobbyist pocketbooks. It's going to go into corporate pocketbooks. And it's really not going to bring us out of the problems we have. I think we're at a potentially transformative moment where what we ought to be talking about is to say that because we've got a weakened healthcare system, we have a weakened system in terms of paid family time off, because we don't have control over corporations, this is the opportunity to do that stuff. Simply throwing $2 trillion isn't going to solve the problem.
And I don't disagree with you, Dean. So here's my thought. And that is that I totally agree that we need to be a little more focused in how we target these dollars. And I'm going to use an example of why the people need to speak up now in unison and scream. And that is, remember what happened with the initial TARP bill. The initial TARP bill was basically a blank check and three pages. On three pages, people went berserk. And as a result, they had to change that in order to really reflect what people were seeing and hearing. I need to go to a break. So let me go to a break. And then when we come back, Dean, I want to continue this conversation. Sure. This is not the best of the attitude. It actually is the best of the attitude. It is the Monday edition of The Attitude. It is our Rethink the Week. We've been talking with Stephen Pimpere, Dean Spiliotis, and Dave Schultz. Ken Barnes is my producer. And of course, this is Arnie Arneson. Stick around for a little climate connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Chicago's Ravenswood neighborhood, you may notice a house with V-shaped roofs and a horseshoe layout.
It's described as Jetsons architecture, so it's really kind of zippy and very expressive of its environmental function.
That's Doug Farr of Farr Associates, the architecture firm that designed the home a little over a decade ago. He says the client, Michael Yanell, wanted to build an energy-efficient luxury home.
He's done very well in life and has ample resources and wanted to send a message to other people at his strata, people of means, to say, don't build a mega mansion, dial it down, build a right-sized house, but make it a net zero model.
In other words, design it to produce as much energy as it consumes. The house is built to maximize sun exposure. In summer, heat is stored in the soil below the home and used to warm the house in winter. And the V-shaped roofs collect rainwater and hide solar panels. When first built, the home was touted as the greenest in America. Farr says it shows that by investing in green building, wealthy people can help pave the way for others.
When you do, you'll make it easier for everyone else that comes later because it will be that much easier and that much lower in cost.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here.
Welcome back to Part 2 of Rethink the Week. So as we were going to the break, Professor Spiliotis, we were talking about how to focus this. And I really do think that there really is a role for people to speak up right now. A lot of people didn't recover from the 2008 economic meltdown. What we know is Wall Street came roaring back. They used the money to buy their stock. The car industry came roaring back. Everyone was a happy camper, except a lot of people are still suffering from 2008. And even if they've just recovered, it's been wiped out. Yeah. So to see that they might have their hand out for money, whether it's an airplane company or whether it's a corporation or whether it's some, you know, gazillionaire, to me, it seems totally irrational when in fact, where you start is at the bottom. Dean.
Well, absolutely. And I think part of the problem is that people don't know how long this is going to last. I think that, you know, initially we were told that let's try this for 2 weeks. And so perhaps some people started to think, okay, well, you know, I won't be able to have my job for a couple of weeks, but I'll get rehired. And now everybody's getting the sinking feeling that this may end up being a couple months, at least into early June, before things really taper off. And then raises the question of, is it going to be a one-time payment? Is it going to be a monthly payment? These are all legitimate questions. And I mean, that obviously should be the first area to address, I think. I mean, people are in real need. And I think, you know, we've seen some government, the federal government, but also state and local governments say, you know, no evictions, we're not going to cut your utilities off, things like that. And that's all helpful. But certainly you want to start with the people who are literally without any financial support now.
So let me say something. Stephen, here's why I think we need to talk about the checks immediately to everyone, not based on income right now. I think we can do this and do the clawback, which is fantastic. AOC is right. And it's just a good idea. It's a win-win. You still get the money back, but you get it out like that without having to figure out who gets what check. But here's the other reason, Stephen, we need to do something immediately. And the people need to sort of let people know they need it yesterday. And that is, we are in an emotional meltdown. And on top of the economic meltdown, we have a social and emotional and mental meltdown. And what people right now are craving is something they can rely on. And right now they can't rely on their job. Right now they can't even rely on their friends because they're social distancing, Dave Schultz. Right now there are so many things that are frayed that the one way of at least giving people some kind of stability, both economically and emotionally, is for them to send them a check and say, this is going to come in every month until this is over, as Dean suggested. We don't know how long, but we will make that determination. We will re-up it every 4 months, because I think at a minimum it's going to be 4 months, probably a year, if not longer. But at least for people to know that, because I think that's how they get to start to breathe again. Because right now people are afraid of breathing. Because unlike the wealthy that can go to their third home someplace on their private jet, these people are stuck and afraid. And I think we need to recognize the mental anguish, let alone the economic anguish.
You know, those of us who sort of spend our time studying poverty and inequality have been complaining for decades now that, depending on how you do the math, right, 60-70% of the American public is one crisis away from total disruption of their household, right? As folks are listening to this, we are 1 week away from April 1st, when rent comes due, when the gas bill comes due, when the electric bill comes due, right? The majority of American households do not have a savings account that they can dip into and say, well, I'm going to have to dip into my savings, oh well, to get us through. They are at the mercy of their landlords and their utility companies. So what I think creates an urgency that is different from the urgency of 2008 is that, you know, this is not like the financial crisis then or the Great Depression, right? This is not a demand crisis, right? It's not, we want to get money out to people so that they can go out and spend it, because we don't want people to do that, right? We don't want them to go out shopping and go out to restaurants, right? It is not that kind of recession, possibly depression. We need to stabilize households because we have directed larger and larger numbers of business across the country to shut down and to unemploy Americans. Dave, so if Schultz, we're going to command that they do that, we've got to step in and ensure that we don't radically immiserate tens of millions of them overnight.
So what are basic services, Dave? Think about this. If we send everyone a check, and maybe $1,200, $2,000, whatever it is, the Bernie check, but a check that seems real given what people have to live on. And what I'm thinking is that, you know why, especially for the bottom 80% of Americans, those checks will go to the landlord. Those checks will go to the electric bill. Those checks will go to buy food. Those checks will go to pay for the gas. Do you know what I mean? And we need those services. Those are the basics. If you want to bail out the food service industry or the gas industry or the electric companies or the hospitals, guess what? By giving people some money so that they can actually pay those bills, you're giving the money not to that family. It doesn't stay in their bank account. It immediately evaporates because it's going in to make sure that those bills are paid. So in an ironic way, all the veins of life are what you're going to be paying, because by giving individuals checks, they're not going to hoard the money. They're going to use the money, and use the money immediately, Dave.
Well, a couple of observations. You know, one of them is I want to agree with I think this is what Stephen said, is that, you know, people do undervalue the importance of the psychological security or the psychological frailty of people who are poor. I mean, for example, you hear people always saying, well, why don't poor people go out and vote, et cetera, like that? Well, oftentimes they have more important things to worry about than casting a ballot on election day. And so I think you're right. Addressing the psychological well-being of America is critical. So far, what I haven't seen, again, this is a leadership issue here, is something coming from the president, from Congress, from somewhere, where somebody is saying, we're going to take care of you and try to sort of reassure the American public and then actually follow up on it. The second thing is that what you're really proposing here, or what's really being proposed here, is if I call it old fashioned, I don't mean to do it in that way, but I'll say it anyhow. This is old fashioned classic what? Keynesian economic theory on one level. It's the idea of saying that what? We have demand, but people can't secure that demand because they lack resources to do so. So we're going to get checks into their hands to be able to do that. But I also want to push further, because, and maybe we're planning on coming to this later in the discussion here, that fundamentally, you know, this is also an economic crisis, that's caused by a public health crisis. And we have to, at the same time, if not antecedent to that, address the public health issue. Because if we don't do that, then we're certainly not going to solve this problem whatsoever. And so somewhere in here, we need to be thinking about the short term, how do we solve this? And then the longer term, and I think, I can't remember who was this, it's my, one of the other, I can't remember which one of the other ones you talked about this, in terms of the larger sort of structural changes that we need to make in our public health system at this point. So again, we've got a series of discrete different things here we need to do from a public policy perspective.
So Dean, here's what I just posted, could I just add,
I really think that what y'all have been saying is critically important at this point in terms of the long-term perspective and short-term too. But as Dave said, the emotional fragility that people are at is in part based on their economic fragility. What Stephen was talking about it's not just poor people, a good portion of the middle class as well are living paycheck to paycheck. For one serious unforeseen crisis, they're going to be really having a hard time surviving. And this is that crisis. So we're all at it. And so in terms of, I think Dave alluded to this earlier, the idea of this minimum income payment of $1,000 or however much it winds up being, to have that not just be a one-off, it almost ought to be like a permanent part of policy. That's a structural change in policy that people who are needy ought to know. And I think what that would do, Arnie, is it would make people more confident. And instead of freaking out that, holy crap, I may really be homeless here on the margin.
Let me go to Dean. At least
feel a little bit confident that they're going to survive this.
Okay, so Dean, Dave Schultz said something about the public health system. And I just heard this. I could not believe it. A Republican from somewhere, a Republican congressman, you know, as we're seeing that we don't have enough hospital beds, that we have so many uninsured and underinsured, that we've always drained our public health system, that they have more beds per capita in Italy than we have here, that we've never had enough masks or ventilators, but we have a lot of MRIs, let me tell you, because you make money with MRIs. So all of a sudden, he was saying, but we have the best healthcare system in the world. He kept insisting, Dean, and I wanted to put my fist to the damn television set. Like, the best what? For what? You know, I mean, so if you have an acute, unusual illness and are rich, it's good for you.
But that's the problem, Dean.
For the rest of us, we find out we have a system that has basically, pardon the expression, pissed away trillions of dollars, not made us healthy, and not put in the requisite investments in a public, robust healthcare system that might not have been able to respond phenomenally to this. But the kind of system we have is grotesque.
Yeah, just real quick, I'll address that, but real quick on what Ken said. I mean, is essentially what you're suggesting, Ken, is what Andrew Yang was pushing for with his guaranteed basic income, essentially $1,000 a month for people who need it. Or actually, he was all Americans, but it's really a variant of that. But I think at a minimum, you have to give people a sense that this is not going to be a one-off, that they will have this cushion for some number of months, based on what all the best epidemiology says is kind of the duration of the initial spike. What you're saying, Arnie, it's interesting you mentioned that. I've seen on the web, on social media, discussion about this very point, that the United States has, from a private, in a private individual medical care perspective, we have a top shelf system, but that's different than a public health. That's very different than public health.
It's a different way
of thinking about healthcare, individual versus the public health or the public good. And so that's been the problem. We're geared towards if you have a problem, you can get MRIs and you know, microsurgery and all kinds of advanced treatments. But that's different than dealing with large groups of people during a health crisis or a public health issue.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's exactly the point I wanted to make. I teach a class in healthcare policy, and the phrase that I use is, we have a great private health healthcare delivery system, but you're right, we do not have a strong public health delivery system in the United States, you know, in the sense of what, anywhere from preventative care to disaster relief to you know, a much more concerted and aggressive programs in terms of addressing what infectious diseases like we have here. Right. And so again, this is, you know, so I will actually concede it and say that if you're rich and you're wealthy and you need a nose job, we probably have one of the best healthcare delivery systems in the world.
But you know, let me just, this is a great story. Yeah. I mean, this is a great story. Utah, do you know what they're doing in Utah? Oh, this is lovely. So Utah, for their public employees, because everything is so expensive, it's not just that we have a porous healthcare system with lots of holes and underinsured and uninsured, but it's a very expensive healthcare system. So for the same operation that you would perform in the United States, you could actually get it 10 times cheaper somewhere else. And this should be the story that we tell almost at the same time as we're talking about COVID-19. In the state of Utah, if you meet certain requirements and you need a certain kind of, I don't know, hip replacement or, I don't know, lung replacement or something, they will send you out of the country to like Mexico or Canada or someplace where they can guarantee that it's quality healthcare, but at 1/10 the price. They will pay for your flight. They will pay for your hotel room and your food. And they'll give you a bonus if you fly out of the country in order to get what you should be getting in Utah. But in Utah, it's 10 times more expensive because it's part of the American healthcare system. And it's not necessarily a better system. It's just ain't cheap, Stephen Pimpare. So what we get right now is such an interesting conversation because I think people are realizing if you don't have a job, can you afford COBRA? If you don't have a job, do you have healthcare? Is the kind of healthcare that you have what you need now with a $5,000 deductible? Because, you know, so all of a sudden, all the things that we were told that we love our choice of health insurance is we're looking at people and going, that's a bunch of BS, Stephen Pimpare. That's not what I want as a choice of health insurance.
You know, this is one of those moments where I struggle to sort of find optimism and hopefulness, right? Because it is extraordinarily difficult in this moment. One of the things that I hope for is that this kind of widespread crisis reveals, I think, two things. The first is the problems that we have known for a very long time are already in existence, right? The weakness of our healthcare system, the problems with tying access to healthcare to employment, the sheer incomprehensible numbers of people who are unhoused, the extraordinarily high rates of infant mortality that don't compare to any other rich democracy, right? The sheer appalling volumes of people, disproportionately men of color, who we lock up behind bars for trivial offenses, right? The list goes on and on and on and on and on. This presents an opportunity for us to come to a collective realization that we are not who we have been telling ourselves we are as a nation, right? That those myths of America are myths. The second thing that I think there's an opportunity for us to realize is that all the things that governments and institutions have been telling us for decades are impossible are not in fact impossible.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Open up the spigots and make unemployment insurance immediately available at much lower. Right. Sort of the list of things that we are demonstrating that we can do like that when we want to.
So, and even on a philosophical or emotional understanding level, Stephen, I couldn't agree more with you. To use the words that Dean was using earlier, he was talking about an individual perspective, focus on ourselves versus a community perspective, focus on the larger whole of society. And if we can turn around that notion that American self-reliance, each of us watching out for number one, or as Adam Smith said about economics generally, you know, the invisible hand, if everybody's selfish and works for only themselves and greedy, yeah, then the invisible hand would make it better for everybody. No, if we have a non-individualized but a social community-oriented viewpoint, right, we can do all the things, Stephen, that you're talking about.
So, Dean, I don't want to leave this conversation without not talking about this. CBS News, I think this story came out maybe Thursday or Friday. New York Stock Exchange boss sold his own stock ahead of coronavirus market meltdown. And what's interesting about the New York Stock Exchange boss is who he's married to, because he's married to a member of the United States Congress. I believe she's a senator.
She's running for Senate.
Oh, she's running for Senate? She's in Congress, but she's running for Senate. Is that what
she
is?
Yes, she's running. I don't know if she's in Congress, but she's running.
She is. Okay. Because she is a elected member of Congress. But what I think is interesting is Charlie Pierce, who I totally adore, from Esquire magazine, was commenting on the CBS piece that I think came out of ProPublica or something. It was just amazing. But he writes, I'm going to move heavily into pitchfork futures, is what he said. He said, I think I'm going to start moving into the pitchfork future. I mean, Elizabeth Warren spoke over and over again about one word, corruption. If there was a word that would be, she should have had that, I have a plan for this. Let's talk about a corruption first. And then let me tell you why my plan is such a good plan. And in a lot of ways, as we're watching them with all the handouts for big corporations, and as we're watching who got bailed out in 2008, and then you find out these people with information that were able to sell their stock before the meltdown, I think someone needs to blend these stories together, Dean, to paint a picture for the American people now about why, if they're going to have a $2 trillion or $10 trillion bailout, it better be for the little people, people at the bottom. And I think this corruption story is important. And I'm wondering where Bloomberg's ads are now. Because frankly, Bloomberg doesn't ad. This was the time for him and Stiers to put together an ad that would tie these pieces together, and the pitchforks would be up there like this.
Yeah, and I should clarify, and Stephen mentioned this through chat, that the senator you mentioned is an appointed senator who's running who's running for senator, and the Republican establishment has gotten behind her instead of Congressman Collins, who wanted to run for that seat as well. So yeah, to your point, I mean, this stuff is really, it's unsurprising, but it's always incredibly distasteful when you read about it and you see the amount of money. I mean, we just had the member of Congress from New York State who was sentenced to, I'm drawing a blank now on his name, sentenced to prison. One of the early endorsers of Donald Trump for the medical, they sold medical stock because they knew their business was not going to get FDA approvals. Mm-hmm. And he's headed to jail for some period of time.
Well, I'm going to go back to Dave. So Dave, you know, Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, let's talk about him now. Remember the appearance of impropriety? Well, honey bun, look what these guys just did. I mean, go after Hunter Biden. I'm going to roll up the flagpole and talk about that New York Stock Exchange boss who sold his stock, who's married to a Republican appointed senator that Donald Trump is behind right now. I mean, it is about the fact that we have to recognize that whether it's actually illegal, the appearance of impropriety, but especially at a time like this, when we are all economically vulnerable, for them to cash out on our economic implosion is beyond horrific. And frankly, that it's not illegal is not surprising, but that they should never appear in public again is what I would suggest, Dave Schultz, because I just think this is the time to sort of connect these dots together.
Yeah. You and I share a common background and for common cause. Yes. We both knew Archibald Cox.
I loved him.
And when Archie came out to Minnesota in 1998, 25th anniversary of the Saturday Night Massacre, he had one of the best lines I had ever heard, where he said to the crowd that he was talking to, and he said, "The rules on money in politics are the rules that determine the rules of the game."
Right.
And I thought it was one of the greatest lines ever. And what we're talking about here is that beyond everything that we've discussed today in terms of economic issues, healthcare issues, and so forth, underlying all this are the rules of the game for how politics is played in the United States.
Right.
It's the rules of the game about who gets to get money. It's about the rules of the game regarding what Congress gets to do when it gets insider information. It's about a whole bunch of the rules that people don't think about that really determine the decision-making. And again, if I were waving my magic wand, I'll just wave my magic pen instead here.
Okay.
If I were waving my magic wand, underlying all of this is what Archie talked about, what Zephyr Teachout talks about a whole bunch of other people have been talking about, is that somewhere underneath this, it's about the fundamental issues of addressing institutional corruption in America and how do we restructure our political institutions to address those. That, I think, is completely being missed.
And now we can, Stephen, now we can sort of connect this institutional rot the idea of how money has so polluted the system that it only serves the rich and doesn't serve the rest of us. I mentioned before, where's Bloomberg's ads and where's Tom Steyer's ads? Now we can talk about the institutional rot and the corruption that will kill people.
And Stephen,
now it's about
before you answer could I add to your question that it's not just the influence of money on politics, but also the very rich and the corporate elites controlling the economy and how they make the economy not work for the average working person.
There's one other dot that I think sort of connects all of those things, and it's sort of the elephant in the room that we really haven't talked much about tonight. You will remember not long ago, the current president of the United States was impeached by Congress of the United States for sacrificing the interests of the nation for his own personal gain. And the party to which he is affiliated chose not to be troubled by that and chose not to remove him from office for those offenses. These are the wages of that particular sin.
And Dean, as I'm listening to all this, I keep thinking about, you know, who is available to step in that could marshal resources, that could organize us. And someone wrote an article at The Guardian, Dean. You know what the article was? Where's the U.S. military? And I don't mean that, you know, the Pentagon and the U.S. military needs to march down the street. But they have been, they get thrown into places like Afghanistan. They get sent into places where, in Haiti or whatever, after the earthquake, where they helped to organize and sort of rationalize certain things. They're sitting on trillions of dollars. We don't even know what's in the Pentagon. There's so many duplicate systems in there. We have no idea. And I'm not talking about, you know, the military in the street. I watched Steve sort of react in a way like, oh my God, what did she say? But I do understand they have moved massive amounts of people, of equipment. They can build hospitals in a second. And for some reason, they are, I don't know who's either not tapping them or what's going on, but why are we using some of the value? This is a national security issue right now. And I don't want to use their military gun focus. I want to use their organizational focus and what they're able to do very nimbly and very quickly. And yet, for whatever reason, that hasn't been part of the conversation.
I think you're over-exaggerating how nimbly the U.S. military works and how effective they are also as an institution.
All right. Well, Dean, let me have Dean respond. Yeah.
Well, no, I was going to say, you know, certainly we think about governors and their ability to use the national, their state national guard when necessary. But yeah, I mean, you can think about the Army Corps of Engineers and the ability to do things like, you know, build temporary bridges and other kinds of facilities and in a very short order. And that's certainly, I assume that's an option for the president as commander in chief. I don't have an answer as to why they're not doing that yet, but I've heard others such as Governor Cuomo say that that's part of what should be going on right now.
Well, and let me just say something, Dave, if you are correct, and after spending trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars on the U.S. military, where it basically is the Pac-Man of our budget, because it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and eating more and more, and they can't respond when asked, ooh, I need to know that too. I want to know that they're ineffective. I want to know that they sold us a bill of goods. I want to know that they can't be there when the country needs them. I want to know this. And frankly, if this is how they've been built, like, you know, we heard about this great economy and we hear about this great healthcare system and we hear about all these great things that our great military. Well, Dave, let's put the pedal to the metal. I want to see what they can do. And if they can't, well, then it's time for us to rethink a lot of stuff.
I don't disagree with that. But if you're looking at how good the military has been in terms of what, let us say, winning wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and building democracy and building other institutions elsewhere, I am not necessarily persuaded that they are the institution to do what you're claiming they can do. And with that, coming back to what I said earlier, they may be appropriate if we figure out what we need to have done. And it's simply saying, let's conscript the military and do stuff. I don't know. If you're talking about we need to build temporary hospitals, maybe yes. If we're talking about the military doctors and healthcare personnel that are, yes. If we're talking about delivering certain things, yes. But again, I think the devil is always in the detail.
I know.
And just to say, send in the Marines. You know, send in the Marines has caused more problems than it probably has solved in American history. So I would temper that type of a statement.
Okay, two points about the military, Arnie. One is that the building bridges and infrastructure and everything is something that FDR employed people, the unemployed people of the country, to do. Our working people can do that and have a job and income. And also, how much do you want to trust the military to be the ones that are running everything in the country?
That's not what I said. I didn't say running everything in the country, but I am suggesting right now, what do they need to run? We need hospitals. You're not going to put a bazooka in a hospital. But what they are supposedly able to do is they can amass, they have significant resources within the Pentagon. They have supposedly been able to do these kinds of things. And again, Stephen, I'm just going to say, I don't need their military prowess in what they're able to do to kill people. I need their military prowess in what they're able to do to organize resources and focus on things. Because one of the things I learned about Afghanistan, for example, is one of the soldiers who talked to me from the field in Afghanistan, he said, they sent me to Afghanistan and I thought I was going to be sent to be a soldier. He said, you know what I found that I had to do in Afghanistan? I had to be a social worker. And nobody trained me to be a social worker, you know? And that was the thing that he suddenly realized.
You've just made our point. They're ill-equipped to do what you're saying you want them to do.
All right.
I hear you. All right, Stephen, last point.
Hypothetical, because what we're talking about is identifying and marshaling the resources that are available in a competent administrative function.
Yes.
And that is precise. I mean, I'm serious. That is precisely right. What is lacking. And that is the core of our problem.
And Dean, you have the last word as we end this Rethink the Week, our first on a Sunday at 4 o'clock to air tomorrow on Monday.
A very short word, please.
A very short word? Okay. Well, you know, I mean, I think at this point, people just want to see as many potential avenues explored as possible. But so much of this depends on the leadership at the top and the ability for the bureaucracy to function as it's designed to function. And, you know, we've seen this problem coming for a long time in terms of the exodus out of the executive branch and the loss of expertise and the loss of people with institutional continuity. And so it just, there's a little bit of kind of a flailing sort of feel to this in the end.
Yep.
A little bit of a failing. And on that note, I know you're being generous. Stephen Pimpare, Dean Spiliotis, Dave Schultz, Ken Barnes, producer. This is Rethink the Week with the Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Thank you so much. And as we go through this, we're going to get better at what we do. But more importantly, we're going to be here for you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my home, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my room, I'm gonna let it shine. Shine now, the road is dark, the way was long, kept on singing that freedom song. My God promised me a rainbow sign, just gotta let my little light shine. Don't give up, don't back down, don't let the liar turn you around. My heart's fixed, made up in mind, I'm going out letting my little light shine. Sure gonna let my little light shine. All in the streets, I'm gonna let it.